I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance. Today, March 1, 2005. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland? Cornish?
Here.
Ellison? Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Messlow? Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Here.
We do have a quorum, so we'll take up the minutes, proposed minutes from the meeting of February 24, 2005. They are in the packet. Are there any questions on that? Representative Soderstrom moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Howes, are you here? If you'd come forward. We've received a request from the agency involved that we bring this bill back off the table, and sure, we'll now do that. House File 42, silences authorized and muffled discharges, natural resources, wildlife control, cormorants, Leech Lake. Explain why we're seeing this bill again today, if you would.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the DNR has indicated that they would like to get to the governor's desk within 3 weeks and sign, so they can start the process at the same time that the federal government excuse me, gives the Leech Lake tribal government and the Department of Natural Resources permission to thin the cormorant population. We also want to have the silencers ready and the necessary people ready to start, because the birds will be returning the end of March.
Okay, so this matter of time necessity, is that?
Yes.
All right. Chair is going to move then that this bill be recommended to pass as amended. Discussion. Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Very good. Next will be House File 215, Representative Cornish. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where this is headed next.
Well, if you want to move the bill, then I think the motion should be that be recommended to pass, but then the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill later in session. If that's acceptable, that's how we'll proceed.
That's good, Mr. Chairman. I move this to be passed and put it into the inclusion of the omnibus bill.
Tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 215 is an agency bill, the DNR enforcement bill. It's a lot of technical changes and some policies. I can walk you through the bill, not in detail, and then we can come back if there's any questions about any of the items. House File 215 on page 1, the first thing we're talking about is criminal history checks for firearms instructors. The reason we'd like to do this is we'd like to do a more intensive criminal history check and get into CGIS data and other data referring to criminal history on the people that are going to be volunteer instructors to work with our youth. Right now, we do the basis of our criminals for our checks are more not in depth as we'd like it to be, and not in the criminal information that we'd like to get it to. So this bill would allow us to go in a little bit deeper. The then on page 3, we have some technical corrections. It's an inadvertent oversight in the revisor's instructions, and it's the transference of convictions on the DWI into the proper disposition in the area that we want to get them to the Department of Public Safety. The page 4, we have an ATV component that talks about ATV safety training, and that addresses a problem that the language used to say that it had to be a certain CC machine. This would allow trainee to take it on any machine that lawfully fits them. On page 5, we have clarification language relating to a person who is age 11 and takes a firearm safety training course and is given a certificate at age 11. It just clarifies that that is not active until they reach the age of 12. It's not a valid certificate to buy a license until they reach the age of 12, or they can't purchase the license until 12 years of age. Page 6, this is a valid firearm safety qualification indicator. In other words, when a person comes in to buy a license, a hunting license, not only do they have to have a DL, they would have to have a valid firearm safety qualification indicator on that license. Some people have in the past come in with licenses as proof, and this is clarifying language that you have to have an indicator that you have taken the safety course, a numbering indicator. Page 6, now this is probably the most controversial here, and it allows motorboats subject to seizure and forfeiture under this section to also include their trailers. At first blush, some thought that this was a furtherance of the forfeiture or a money-making deal or whatever from the DNR. But what it is to give you a scenario, a conservation officer or a boat and water patrol safety officer or deputy is on the water and they confiscate a boat. When they come back, and many times they'll be working alone, and there's nothing to do with that $10,000, $20,000 boat. You have to secure it. There's a lot of liability there. This would allow you to also seize the trailer and take that too and load the boat up. It's different than a snowmobile and a utility trailer in that a snowmobile you can load into just about anything. But a boat, a trailer is peculiar to the boat, and we just about need it because if the person challenges it, if they're for their protection also, and if they win back the boat, or if it's not forfeited, at least the boat would be kept in the proper order, and you wouldn't have scuff marks all over from stuff and an inadequate trailer or some other conveyance. We've heard from not only conservation officers, but Boat and Water Patrol that this is needed, and this would allow us to use the boat that was, and also, not only would be protection of the boat, but the financing package, a lot of times they're financed together, and it would make it simpler to have the boat and the trailer in the same financing package under forfeiture. Then,
Was that language that you just described, was that part of the original bill, or was that amended on in environment policy?
I believe that was an amendment that came on in environment policy.
Was it your amendment, or was it from someone from the committee?
It was the, yes, it was an author's amendment brought to me by the agency.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, on page 9, then, we have some clarifying language on, actually some additional language from the charitable gambling funds in the past hadn't been able to use those funds for certain activities. And this would include the activities listed and get rid of some old language. This was done, I believe, in cooperation with the Gambling Control Board. They had a part in crafting the language, so it's already been run by them. And it lists the activities there from line 10 through line 20. The reason it was needed, especially from 18 through 20, is because there's language, of course, in the charitable gambling about not using it for law enforcement. This would... since the DNR Enforcement Division is law enforcement, this exempts this portion to make sure that it's used by supplies and materials for safety training education programs coordinated by law enforcement. It just makes sure that it's not going to actual law enforcement, but it's an educational program by them. And anything I missed? That's the rundown of the bill. I have Pat Watts from the DNR here to answer any technical questions, or I, if you have any members.
Are there any questions from the committee on this? Representative Cornish, there appears to be no questions. Upon hearing your discussion of your bill, it seems you might want this bill to be reviewed by your Environment Finance Committee and for possible inclusion in an environment omnibus bill. I see you nodding. Do you want to do that?
I would like to move that to the...
Why don't you amend your motion then to reflect that 215 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Environment Finance Committee?
That would be good, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on that amended motion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman, House File 1099. Representative Newman, if you'd move that, I think, to include, if you'd move the bill be passed, I think it would be my request that the motion reflected it be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would so move.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a bill that was, it's an agency bill brought to me by the Department of Public Safety. And the purpose of the bill is to correct an ambiguity that is contained in Minnesota Statute 609.763. And that particular statute involves fraudulent or attempt to fraudulently obtain gambling prizes. In the statute that is the subject of this bill, Subdivision 2 deals with penalties, and in Subdivision 2 it specifically indicates that the dollar amount and the word that is used is involved. If the dollar amount is a certain amount, it's a misdemeanor. If it is an increased amount that is involved, it's a gross misdemeanor. And the third provision is if you get enough money involved, it is a felony. When we drop down to Subdivision 3, they talk about aggravated jurisdiction, where they're going to add up the amount of money that is involved. The statute uses a different word. They use the word obtained. The problem that arose is comes out of a court case out of Stearns County, the state of Minnesota versus Anthony Joel Thielen. And in that particular case, the trial court judge dismissed the aggravated or aggregate felony charge, and he did so on the basis that the word in Subdivision 3 obtained was different than the word in Subdivision 2, the penalty phase of being involved. And he distinguished that language, the judge did, saying that under the statute, they had to actually prove that somebody, quote, obtained the funds. So we've got an ambiguity in a statute. And the judge said, it clearly indicated in his memorandum, that the court was giving the plain meaning of the word obtained, and that if there is any ambiguity, that the legislature must fix the problem. So that's why I'm here. And I am simply moving forward with a bill. You will notice on the bill that is before you, there is a one-word change. And all that does is to use the word involved consistently throughout the statute and thereby remove any kind of ambiguity. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Any questions? Of the author. There's no questions. Chair lays the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You, members.
Representative Paulson here, yeah. At this time, we'll take up the next item, which is a presentation by the DHS on child support collections and related issues. And just as a reminder to the committee, we have a really good analysis in our packet on how support laws work in the state, so I recommend a review of that on our time. Good morning, sir. Tell us your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Waylon Campbell. I'm the director of the Child Support Enforcement Division at DHS. My understanding is that you would like an overview of the program and then entertain questions?
Yes, please.
Okay. The mission of the Child Support Program is to benefit children through establishing paternity, establishing support orders, modifying those orders, and collecting child support. Basically, there are three different types of child support that we collect. We collect what we call basic support, which is cash support, medical support, where we establish insurance, if there is insurance available for children, and child care support. The program serves 247,000 families and has collections of about $600 million per year. Child support program is a nationwide program that we interact with other states as well as doing our own cases. For example, we have sent 26,000 cases to other states for service because one of the parents lives in those states, and we have ourselves received about 10,000 cases from other states to service here in Minnesota for the same reason. We provide services to essentially two different kinds of individuals. One individual would be a custodial parent who's receiving public assistance, most likely MFIP, or it could be medical assistance, or it could be certain foster care services. And they are required to assign their rights to the state, and we get involved in all those cases where one of the parents is not in the home. We also are required to service individuals who apply for services at one of our offices. And these people would come in and fill out an application, and they would receive essentially the same services that we provide for those people in public assistance. Many of our people that are not receiving public assistance right now at one time did. Approximately 74% of the non-public assistance cases were at one time public assistance cases themselves. Like many of the other programs at DHS, the child support program is state supervised and county administered. State responsibilities include establishing and maintaining the PRISM. PRISM is the automated child support system that does an awful lot of stuff for us, from case management to actually initiating certain enforcement activities to handling the payments in and the payments out. It's a very comprehensive system. It also does our federal reporting and things like that. We provide training to county workers. We take care of the federal reporting requirements. We do policy and procedure development based on what passes in the legislature and in the federal Congress. We also provide certain customer service and evaluate county performance. The counties are really where the rubber hits the road. That's where individuals have most of their contact with the child support program. That's where the establishment and the enforcement functions mostly take place, where paternity occurs, paternity establishment, that is, where orders are established, where orders are modified. Most individuals who interact with the program, their contact is with either county child support workers, who we call child support officers, or assistant county attorneys or child support magistrates. I would just add in passing, though, that in some cases, paternity establishment is done in hospitals through an administrative process using a form called a recognition of parentage. This can also be done in the counties, but it's also available in Minnesota hospitals. We have a number of enforcement mechanisms that we use to enforce child support obligations. Not all mechanisms work in all cases. Most common, most collections come into our office via income withholding. Income withholding is not only an enforcement mechanism, but it's just kind of the way the court orders support to be paid. So it's not necessary. If you're paying support through income withholding, it really does not indicate at all that you were ever deficient in any way. It's just the way support is supposed to be paid and how the court orders it. For certain delinquencies, we certify those delinquencies to the IRS and to the State Department of Revenue and offset any refunds that are available. Most recently, we've collected about $30.7 million through that process. We also suspend driver's licenses for individuals who fall behind. I believe it's 3 months' worth of current support obligation and meet other criteria. They are notified of the pending action and are given an opportunity to enter into a payment agreement, but if all that fails, then we would notify the Department of Public Safety to suspend their license. We also interact with financial institutions where individuals have assets that are potentially offset for delinquent child support obligations. And we have a new hire reporting center where all employers are required to report new hires, and we match those with our cases, and that helps us keep current when people are moving from job to job and from place to place. There are many other mechanisms that we use, but those I think are probably the most common and the most effective. Funding. The child support program is funded by the federal government. The federal government matches 66% of our administrative costs, and when I say our, I mean both state and county. The feds also pay for genetic testing. They'll pay 90% of the cost. And they also pay us incentive payments based on our performance. Most recently, we collected about $13.5 million in Minnesota. We passed those incentives on to the counties. The ways in which we earn incentives are one for doing paternity establishment. You get the maximum incentive if you establish over 80%. Most recently, we were at 98%. Order establishment, you get the maximum available if you're over 80%, and we were at 81%. Collecting current support, again, the standard to get all the incentives that you are due is 80%. We're at 69%. And the percentage of cases with an arrears collection, also 80% is the standard to get the maximum federal incentive, and we are at 66%. You also get an incentive payment for your cost effectiveness. To receive the maximum, you need to be at $5, and we're at $4.08. That's pretty much a very brief overview, very brief. And I would be happy, Mr. Chair, to entertain any questions that your members might have.
I'm sure we have a few questions. I might start off with a couple, Mr. Campbell, and that is not in order of importance, but in order that I took some notes. What is the current you mentioned $600 million is collected per year, and what is the current outstanding balance of child support owed under existing orders in the state of Minnesota right now?
Are you, Mr. Chair, are you asking about the arrears that are out there too?
Yes.
I think we have about $1.5 billion in arrearages.
Under existing either paternity orders, marital dissolution, support orders?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Does that number fluctuate, or is that pretty much steady?
No, that number increases every year.
Okay.
As I mentioned before, Mr. Chair, we collect about 69% of the current support obligation, and I think that is the entire receivable is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $800 and some million, so that's about $200 million that goes uncollected.
again, not in order of importance, but you mentioned the federal government provided 66% of your administrative costs. Administrative costs being defined as your total cost to run your department.
Right. That's correct, Mr. Chair. The total cost to run the child support program.
Right.
Salaries, computer expenses, supplies, whatever they are.
How much was that amount in dollars?
Mr. Chair, the total cost of the program, I think, is about $144 million. That's total dollars. When you end up, the federal government pays about 75% of that. The state cost is about $12.5 million. The county cost is about $22 million.
How many employees are in the child support collection department? How many employees do you have?
Are you talking about just DHS?
Yes. Just your section of the DHS, the Child Support Enforcement Division. Or maybe more precisely, how many computer key entry personnel do you have? How many folks running computers tracking this do you have? Can you give me an idea?
Mr. Chair, we have about not quite somewhere between 180 and 200 people at DHS working in the child support program.
Okay. Representative Cornish, question?
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if you had any way of tracking the ratio of male versus female, who pays, who the child support goes after, and what kind of a ratio. And then the second one is, if rather than the cruel, unusual punishment, the way that it's operated now, if the system was more fair overall for both parties, do you think that you would get a lot more collection, or what you're able to gather from the input you get, if it was a fairer system, would you be collecting more, or people not paying sometimes out of frustration or just feel it's an unfair system so they quit their job or quit paying, or... So it's kind of a philosophical question, I suppose.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I think in terms of getting to your first question, I don't really know precisely, but I think I read fairly recently that about 85% of the custodial parents are female, which would leave about 15% male. With regard to your second question, we continually strive to make the program more fair, but we are constrained in certain ways that I don't think the public always understands. There are certain activities that which we are supposed to engage in that represent only part of the problem that individuals in real life face. Real individuals have questions concerning custody, they have questions concerning visitation and all these things. These are issues that are very real to people and that are linked up with child support matters, but we don't operate in those areas, and we're not funded to, we have no mandate to. And I think that causes a lot of the consternation. I think when we find new ways to deliver services that it's where we can retain people's confidence, then we will certainly endeavor to do that.
Representative Sotis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about taking the driver's license, and I'm kind of new to this. When did they start taking the driver's license, and do you know how many driver's licenses they've revoked? And is that productive when, of course, usually a person would lose their job when they have a driver's, when they lose their driver's license because they couldn't get to work? Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, yes. I don't have right at my fingertips when that law went into effect, but I can get that information for you. Before an individual's license is suspended, they are notified that there is a problem and that they are given an opportunity to enter into a payment agreement to come to terms with this. In most instances, in all instances when they're suspended, is that this doesn't happen. Support payments aren't made. People do not come forward, and so we take the necessary enforcement action, which is to initiate the process to have the license suspended. Quite a few licenses get suspended, and I'm personally very concerned by that. I think at the last count we had suspended about 29,000 licenses. So I think that's an alarming statistic.
Mr. Campbell, I think I would like a follow-up letter with a precise number on that also. Perhaps you could give us back the back 3 years of how many automobile driver's licenses were suspended, how many recreational licenses were suspended, and if you have the information, how many of those were reinstated with your knowledge. Also, how many property liens were docketed over the last 3 years. And if there's any professional licenses that have been suspended, maybe you could supply that number as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we'll try to get that information for you. Right off the top of my head, I'm not sure we can get that information on the liens, but we'll see what we can do.
Okay. That'd be fine. Additional questions? Representative Newman. And then Eastland. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, is there any portion of the money that is collected on behalf of the custodial parents utilized to reimburse the state for the cost of this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, if a person is receiving public assistance, MFIP, for example, we pass the money through to that custodial parent, but that money that's passed through is subtracted from the grant that individual gets. So we do forward the money on, but if they're getting regular child support payments, then their MFIP grant would be reduced by that amount. Also, in instances where arrearages accrue and child support is not paid on a public assistance case, but they got the full MFIP amount, we will try to recover that money as well.
All right, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Campbell, you said that there was about $1.5 billion in outstanding child support debt. Can you give us a perspective of that number? How much of it's 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? How long has that number been accumulating? And does dollars ever drop off the end as being uncollectible?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland. We do report to the Department of Finance an amounts that we consider uncollectible. Those haven't been taken off the books, however, so they stay on the books. The amounts go up every year. We don't collect everything, so the receivables do go up. That $1.5 billion figure goes way back to the dawn of time, when we started the child support program, at least back to 1975. Some of the debts that accrue, sometimes before a person even comes in to apply for services, they've already accrued a massive arrearage, and we just load that arrearage into our system. There's also medical confinement expenses that are there. There's lots of different expenses, and I can get you a more accurate portrayal of for like the last 3 or 5 years, if you would like that information.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that I would value that. It would seem to be that a more valuable number would be what's an outstanding amount that's collectible, that's still on the radar screen is something that, I mean, that would be seem to be a more valuable number. Another question related more to this committee. Many of our prisoners that are incarcerated are also required to pay child support. How much child support is being collected from prisoners?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I do not have the answer to that question. I can try to, again, find out.
I think that would be another interesting thing to know, and I'd also like to know how much of the arrears in the system, in this number that we've got here, is attributable to people that are incarcerated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we do, and the counties as well, work with the prisons to try to deal with those matters of people, especially in long-term incarceration, having their obligations go up. There's remedies that can be done to alleviate that situation. We're not successful in all cases. In just about every child support case, it requires a certain amount of individual initiative on the part of the individual, and many people don't follow through. But we do try to remedy that situation as best we can.
But you don't think there's any way we get any numbers about what kind of what kind of child support would be coming out of those kind of situations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we're going to try to find that information for you. We'll have to run an ad hoc report. We don't regularly get that.
Okay, but there is an expedited process that can deal with the child support obligation if somebody is going to be incarcerated, so that the can recognize the fact that they're no longer having any income and that they. Is there some kind of a process in place? You said you work with the counties and work with law enforcement to kind of deal with those situations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, that's correct. I think we're hampered by resources, and the need far exceeds the amount of resources that we can put at that problem. But there are remedies that can be implemented with regard to people in jail to help address and to stop, you know, vast amount of arrearages accruing.
Okay, it'd be interesting to get some statistics about what those numbers are. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Paymar, then Smith. Representative Paymar.
Is Representative Paulson here yet?
I'm sorry.
Is Representative Paulson here yet? Because I won't ask the question.
No, we're keeping an eye out for him. We are prepared, however, to have staff help us walk through the bill so we can get on his bill. But please ask your question.
I just had a question about the Title IV 4D program. Can you just explain that a little bit? It's confusing to me about who can apply for 4D services. It's not financially means tested, if I understand this correctly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymer, that's correct. In fact, I have a handout for you. Section D was established, the child support program, in 1975. And the act, if your question is who can apply for services, anybody can apply for services. There are no eligibility requirements. The information I pass out to you is information pertaining to federal law, federal regulations, and I think some narrative language from the Congressional House and Ways Committee clarifying that is in fact the case. This program is not just for public assistance individuals, but that other individuals can apply, and that anyone who applies needs to receive services.
So that, Mr. Chair, so there's been legislation introduced last session and this session to make that means tested. What would happen to our federal match if such legislation were to become law?
If the risk would be that it would jeopardize all of our child support funding and possibly our TANF funding. We are required as a state who agrees to receive federal matching funds for the child support program to maintain a state plan that is approved by the federal government. It is a federal state plan requirement that we offer these services to any individual who applies. If we do not offer those services or we deny services to the individuals, it would be up to the federal government to make a determination, but my guess would be that they would sooner or later terminate our funding. To have a TANF program, you need to have an approvable 4D funding, so the TANF funding would also be jeopardized.
Thank you.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. On the outstanding $1.5 billion, is it possible to get at least the financial demographics of those people? I mean, are these 85% of these people in poverty? Are they, you know, 85% people who just refuse to pay but have the financial means? Is there any way to find out a demographic of any of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't think we have that information, and I'm pretty sure we don't have it, partly because we don't have up-to-date financial information on people. The one time when we would get financial information on an individual is when that child support order is set or being modified. That could be years ago, and trying to coordinate all, I just don't think our system would be able to put together that information. I'm sorry.
Okay. Second question.
Representative Ellsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not certain that this is your section of the department, but it's my understanding that spousal maintenance is no longer being collected. Is that part of your program? It's my understanding that Department of Human Services made a policy change and decided not to collect that anymore.
Mr. Kim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's correct. But we also have information from the federal government that indicates that we're not supposed to be doing that. We were, but we're not supposed to. So that's why we changed the policy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilson.
Just clarification. So that is your part of the department or a different part of the department?
It's not any part of the department.
Did it used to be yours?
It used to be ours, yes.
All right. Thanks.
Representative Eastland, you had another question?
Yeah, I just I'm back at the $1.5 billion. Could you how much of that $1.5 billion, if any, is interest or penalties in excess of just actual child support orders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think we're going to have to wait for us to get a report to get. To get you whatever we can on that information. Actually, I think I do have an answer, Mr. Chair, for Representative Hillstrom's earlier question, in that there is some federal information out about where arrearages are accruing, and I believe the figure that the federal government has given for nationwide, and I think it basically applies to Minnesota well, that 70% of the arrearages are owed by people who make less than $10,000 a month.
I have a follow-up question.
A month or a year.
Oh, a year, I'm sorry.
Where does the federal government get that information if they don't get it from the states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think they had a contracted study, and I think they looked at IRS information reported, and I'm not quite sure what type of analysis was done.
Okay, I have one more question, Mr. Whalen. Is any of our federal reimbursement or the dollars that we get to fund our child support enforcement efforts in Minnesota, is that related to the $1.5 billion number? Is our funding our funding that we get from the feds related to how much we have in the arrears?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, no, it isn't. We get funding through those through administrative costs, so that they reimburse salaries, et cetera, like that, and basically our efforts, and also the incentives that we pass on to counties that are related to program outcomes that we get. But in one of those outcomes is collections on cases where there are arrears, but that's about as close as I think any of our funding gets to that arrearage amount.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hillstrom, did you have another question? No. I have one question that occurred to me in discussing the issue of interest owed on court-ordered child support. Is it true that after a non-custodial parent makes 36 consecutive monthly payments that your department waives any further collection of the interest?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that after 36 consecutive months, the matter can go to court and the court can waive it.
So any waiving of any interest following a 36-month plan does not come from your office? It would come from a court order or a court review.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Hillstrom.
A follow-up would be, is that in state law that happens, or is that a department policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's in state law. We're all actually trying to have that reduced to 12 months.
Very good. Thank you for your time. And if we have any bills that come through this committee that are in this area, we may ask you to return. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we'll go to committee. We'll go to the last remaining item on the agenda, which is House File 1244. And correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Murphy, but the record should reflect that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the record, as we take up this bill, should reflect the record should reflect that your name is or has or should be stricken from this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you.
Very good. Can we get? The chair is going to move House File 1244. It is before the committee, and I'm going to ask our committee staff, Mr. Diebel, to walk us through the bill, please.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1244 attempts to create an all-felon DNA database in Minnesota. In general terms, it will require this year all felons arrested for violent or predatory offenses to submit a DNA sample upon arrest, and then in 2010 it would require all felons, regardless of the type of offense, to submit a DNA sample. I'll take you through section by section here. Section 1 simply authorizes the superintendent to establish rules to collect the DNA and to handle the DNA from arrestees. This would be a policy shift from just current practice of collecting it from convicted felons. Section 2 requires the superintendent to put those that handle DNA evidence under oath that they'll administer the program and consistently with the rules and laws requiring DNA samples. Both of the first sections are technical in nature. Section 3 begins the substantive changes, and it calls for the DNA samples to be taken from persons arrested for violent and predatory offenses. The list of crimes contained in Section 3 is in current law in Section 609.117, and that is the original baseline DNA statute. And that was established many years ago to collect DNA samples from felons that were convicted of violent and predatory offenses. Subsequent to that, the legislature enacted a law that allowed for collection of samples from all convicted felons. But the original list remained in statute because the one that called for all felon collection was a temporary law that sunset every 2 years. And so we've been doing that. The legislature's been doing that the last 2 years to require all felon DNA collection, but the law sunsets every 2 years. So the only permanent statute right now is that all DNA samples from violent predatory offenders convicted of those offenses are required. This statute would take the language from 609.117 and say if you're arrested for a violent or predatory offense, then you must submit a DNA sample to the law enforcement office, agency that arrests you. It also provides for some of the technical side of transferring the DNA evidence to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and there's a 72-hour requirement that the law enforcement agency must transmit the samples within 72 hours. Currently, law enforcement must transmit fingerprint evidence within 24 hours of taking it, so that gets to the BCA quickly. This would give them 72 hours to transfer DNA evidence collected from violent felons. The next section, Section 4, would go into effect in 2010. This would make the state an all-felon arrestee DNA database state. it would say, it basically says that any felony offense that is not listed in Section 3, and if you're arrested for any felony offense not listed in Section 3, then you must submit a DNA sample upon arrest for the felony. Again, this wouldn't take place until 2010. Section 5 is a modification of current law that discusses how the BCA handles identification data. Currently, it's all lumped together regarding fingerprints, DNA. The way the bill is drafted, it carves out a subdivision specifically addressing DNA evidence. In the first subdivision, which is current law, it allows for identification data other than DNA to be returned to the defendant if they're upon a demand, if the defendant demands it, and without an expungement order, when charges are dismissed prior to a determination of probable cause, or the prosecuting authority declines to file charges. This is a general exception. It doesn't require the person to go through formal expungement of the records if they weren't, if there wasn't probable cause or they weren't charged. That language does not carry through to Subdivision 2 for DNA evidence. Under current law, DNA samples and records for arrested persons, say for example if a law enforcement officer takes a DNA sample from a crime scene and then arrests someone, they would have the, and then they subsequently match it to the person, they would have the arrestee DNA, but they can't destroy it pursuant to the current law. And that would be an exception to the rule I just mentioned regarding giving it back to the person if they don't have probable cause. So the current law carves out an exception for DNA, and it places a higher standard when there is then placed on other identification data. So the current law provides for law enforcement to keep DNA evidence more readily than it does them to keep fingerprint evidence or other identity data in cases where the person is not charged or there's not probable cause.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Deagle, could you say that one more time?
Sure.
Current law allows them to keep the DNA evidence longer and differently than they would have kept fingerprints.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, in certain cases that has to do with whether there's probable cause to charge the person, but under current law, it provides for a defendant when there's not probable cause or he's not charged with an offense to, upon demand of the law enforcement agency, to receive his identification data back. But when, for DNA evidence, it's a little bit different standard. If there is probable cause, even if the law enforcement agency doesn't charge the person, then they're not obligated to return the DNA evidence. And it's not as if they're taking DNA evidence from the arrestees as a matter of course, because that's not allowed under current law. It would just have to be in the circumstances where they happen to come across the DNA evidence. And this may be something. This is really a practical issue that maybe someone from the law enforcement community and the audience could address and say, how does it come in? What do they do? How do they get the DNA evidence from someone that's arrested? And then what's the practice for handling it? But my understanding from reading the statutes is that there is a different standard for DNA evidence as opposed to fingerprint evidence. As I mentioned,
sorry, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the subdivision 2, I have a question. So someone gets arrested when you do for a felony, the second phase, and they're found not guilty or they do not go forward with the charges, but they find probable cause. We have a tendency to attempt to run DNA matches. And in the process, they run a DNA match and they find a second crime that has a DNA match. But you're not entitled to keep the DNA, or the person can petition to get it back. What happens?
I would appreciate some support from perhaps someone from the BCA, but my understanding is that they would be entitled to use that evidence that they weren't required to return it. Again, the person has to demand that they get their materials back, but if they weren't entitled to under the law, then it's the BCA is entitled to use it for that purpose, or law enforcement to run matches. But perhaps we could have Frank Dolish from the BCA comment on that.
Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at here is, you know, someone gets arrested because you can't prove the crime over here. You have a DNA match, or you have DNA, but you don't have a match, and you think you know who did it. And so you arrest somebody for felony property crime or for drugs or something, and you take a DNA match, and then all of a sudden you run it, and you don't end up charging them over here for this crime because they really didn't maybe do it. But you get a DNA match for this crime. You just found a new way to connect your criminals, and I'm just curious as to what happened.
Is that a question?
Well, some clarification maybe. You know, Mr. Chair, I tend to support DNA testing, but there comes a point when you see how the ability to, you know, manipulate goes a little far.
We do have three or four witnesses who have testimony in an area of expertise upon which these questions are currently touching or driving at. So I would recommend that we, 5 minutes or not. So let's proceed with the walkthrough, and then let's get on to our testifier.
Mr. Chair, members, quickly on Subdivision 2, it addresses DNA samples specifically, and it allows for someone that's not convicted and doesn't have a past felony conviction within the last 10 years to seek an expungement order under 609A. And then that, under that chapter, they would go forward under a provision that puts the burden of proof on the law enforcement agency to prove that they're not entitled to expungement when they weren't convicted for the crime. But if they do have a past crime, then they wouldn't be entitled to seek expungement, a past felony conviction, excuse me. The next section, Section 6, is intended to provide specific language for privacy protection of the records and information on DNA contained in the BCA database. The information would be labeled private data on individuals pursuant to the terms used in Chapter 13. And then it also specifies that DNA evidence may only be used for law enforcement purposes by authorized law enforcement personnel. Section 7 imposes a penalty on the local agencies if they fail to forward the DNA samples in a timely fashion. This is mirrors the current requirement or penalty imposed if they don't forward fingerprint evidence. I don't imagine it's used very often, but it's really a conforming amendment since it's of the same type of activity. Section 8 combines the... I mentioned earlier that 609.117 is the baseline DNA collection statute for convicted felons. We also have 609.119, which is the language that sunsets every 2 years and requires collection of DNA from all convicted felons. Section 8 simply combines the two and makes them permanent. There'll no longer be a need for a sunset. All convicted felons will be required to submit a DNA sample in Minnesota. Section 9 amends the expungement chapter, simply reflecting the changes to the law made in Section 5, and thereby allowing for expungement of DNA samples. Section 10 strikes current language in the expungement chapter that prohibits a court from expunging DNA evidence, and this actually makes it easier for someone that's not convicted of a felony and under the arrest statute to have their DNA evidence expunged or sealed. And then Section 11 contains some blank appropriations to fund the collection of arrestee and convicted felon DNA. And 12 repeals the sunset, the language that's set to sunset 609.119. And then finally, Section 13 is a advisor instruction that instructs their advisor to update statutes in 2010 when the all felon arrestee data DNA collection would begin, so that the statutes are automatically updated.
Representative Paulson, we're having some questions, and then you do have some testifiers. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Debo, could you go back to Section 4 and clarify that part about juveniles for me again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, could you repeat that word?
Juveniles?
Juveniles. The my understanding that if a juvenile can adjudicated for a felony offense or tried as an adult would have to submit arrested for would have to submit a DNA sample.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Debo, what happens to that information then after the juvenile is no longer a juvenile? That DNA evidence.
Mr. Deeble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's my understanding that if they were adjudicated delinquent or convicted of offense, that it would remain in the DNA database unless they sought an expungement order, which I might mention, it is juveniles are entitled to expungement orders at a lower standard than most. Or juvenile offenses are entitled to expungement more readily than adult convictions.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Debo, an EJJ then would have to go to expungement?
Mr. Debo.
Mr. Chair, assuming that most EJJs are felony-level offenses, then yes, and they were convicted of that or adjudicated delinquent, depending on where their sentence ended up, they would need to seek an expungement order.
But what if they weren't convicted? They were just
arrested. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, then it would fall back to the procedures as to whether there was probable cause and whether they would be entitled to expungement for a lack of a conviction or adjudication indeed they weren't convicted or adjudicated delinquent, with the lower standard or the burden being placed on the prosecuting authority as to why it shouldn't be expunged. But they would need to take affirmative steps to have it removed.
And would, Mr. Chair, Mr. Debo, is there anything in here that would inform them that they would have to take these further steps?
Mr. Debo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, no, there are no notice provisions in the statute.
Representative Paulson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I apologize for being late. I know you've walked through sections of the bill already and had some questions, which is good. I'll just do a brief statement, if I could, Mr. Chair, and highlight why I'm bringing this legislation forward. I know there's members of the law enforcement community and the BCA, I think, that are going to provide some more background information and some supportive testimony, and I think you'll hear from some others as well. Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I know that certainly it is a common belief that public safety is a top legislative priority for all legislators, and I do believe that keeping violent offenders and repeat offenders off the streets should be a top goal of all of us. Through the use of advanced technology and identification and investigation, we have the ability to use DNA, being the fingerprint of the 21st century, to help crack down on crime and help identify guilty folks, to exonerate the innocent, and provide swift justice for victims. The proposal that has been laid out before you not only is moving to eliminate the sunset for DNA collection for convicted felons, but also going a step further by requiring those DNA samples from persons who are arrested on felony charges by establishing an all-felon DNA database here in the state of Minnesota. The legislation has been laid out in two stages, essentially, to phase it in. The first phase would begin in July, which does require law enforcement to collect at the time of booking a DNA sample of people who are arrested on suspicion of a felony for a violent or predatory felony level of offense. So those types of offenses include murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, all the sexual criminal conduct crimes. The reason I chose these offenses is based not only on the state of Virginia, which has implemented a similar database for violent arrest fees, but these are crimes that are essentially the worst of the worst. And in states like Virginia are having a tremendous success rate of 300 to 400 hits per year of collecting this data and matching it to previous unsolved crimes. And so it is a tremendous assistance. As an example, in Chicago, there was a man who was paroled on a felony theft conviction, a theft conviction, with the condition of his parole to provide a DNA sample. That individual then provided the DNA. The police matched that DNA to an unsolved murder. He was charged with that crime and three additional rapes as well that occurred over the course of 4 years. He had been arrested actually 75 times previously. This is a pattern. These are pattern offenders, 75 times. His DNA was not taken until 2003. Had it been taken in 1993, upon his first felony arrest, his victim would likely still be alive, obviously, and the rapes would not have occurred. And looking at what other states have done and gone in this direction, there are four other states, essentially, that have gone in this direction. The state of Virginia, as I mentioned, the state of California, the state of Louisiana, as well as Texas. And so stage two of the legislation before you would be implemented in 2010, looking at having any person that is arrested on felony charges to provide the DNA sample. This gives the state more time to adjust. It gives the state more time in collecting this broader base of samples, analyzing the samples, and storing the information. I think you've gone over some of the provisions in the legislation that talk about being mindful of civil rights and constitutional rights of individuals who are arrested for serious crimes. If there are charges that are not brought later against them, the individuals have rights to have the records expunged, similar to our fingerprint laws and statutes. Beyond that, essentially this is an opportunity to provide more accurate, more reliable information to crack down on crime. It is a natural evolution of a long-standing fingerprint requirement that is collected right now. And it is more likely to be recovered. DNA is more likely to be recovered, actually, from a crime scene than a fingerprint. And I think you'll hear from the law enforcement community that's coming forward. Often there are no witnesses available. There are no fingerprints available. And DNA is the link. It is the link. And there is a link in Kansas City over the weekend. They caught a killer that's been out there for 30 years, matched through DNA. And so it is an opportunity to really exonerate the innocent, capture the bad guys, and that's why I brought the legislation forward, Mr. Chair. I know there's a number of individuals that would like to testify.
We do want to get to that, but we have one question, Representative Ellis, and then we want to move to the testimony.
I had to ask my question when I heard...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellis.
What did I say?
Your Honor.
Well, you're the Honorable Steve Smith. Anyway, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to ask the question. I was going to hold it until I heard Representative Paulson mention natural evolution. Here's my question about natural evolution. We start out seeking DNA evidence of sex offenders. We then move to DNA evidence of violent and predatory offenders, but upon conviction. We move then to all felons, but upon conviction. Now we're moving to all in a stepwise fashion from violent offenders pretty much right away, and then all felons by 2010. Why doesn't your bill go to, say, non-felons, misdemeanors, driving after suspension, and even why even stop there? Why not go for birth? Why not just tell all hospitals, take everybody's DNA right there? I mean, well, I heard somebody say move, so move, and that sounds cute, but I mean, this is a democratic nation, and the most important thing for us to do, I'm afraid to tell you, is not to fight public safety, but to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the state of Minnesota, which says that we only search and seize people based on reasonable cause, probable cause. And in your case, there may not be probable cause when you're taking somebody's most personal, most private information that they have available. And so my question to you is, how far are we going with this? Are we going to non-felons? Are we going to the hospitals and the birth rooms and the maternity wards? And also, why can't even a judge be allowed to cross off on whether or not there's probable cause to support the crime before you want to take somebody's DNA? So there are two questions for you.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, The crimes that are laid out before you in the legislation deal with felonies. And often these felonies and the people who commit felonies have a pattern level of offense. It could be theft, it could be robbery, it could be other crimes. And the states that have implemented this legislation are having a tremendous success rate at catching bad guys and protecting victims. There's no doubt that this legislation is saving lives, and this legislation could save lives here in the state of Minnesota. That's why we focused, and I chose to focus on the felony convictions and the felony charged arrestee information. In terms of the difference in, you know, going farther down the road and in big government intruding, I think there is a big difference between an innocent person standing on the street and an innocent person who is arrested for a sex crime or a rape or a murder. And this is a non-invasive procedure where DNA is collected essentially with a cotton swab. It is analyzed with 13 different indicators that are. It's not every DNA component, but it's 13 indicators that the FBI uses, just 13 pieces, in order to match to crime scenes. So I think it's entirely appropriate for the legislature to consider this and in order to make sure we are protecting our citizens and stopping future crime and exonerating the innocent. It is a tremendous opportunity to exonerate the innocent, and we've seen success stories of DNA used for that capability. And in terms of the judge having additional discretion, that's something I think that is valid for the committee to discuss, but I think it is more crucial for this committee and hopefully the legislature to move in this direction as other states have done successfully.
Let's take one more question. Representative Paymer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, Representative Paulson, maybe I'm confused. You keep talking about the worst of the worst and those arrested for murder, assault, sexual assault under Section 3 of the bill, but if I'm reading it correctly and understand the testimony in Section 4 in 2010, it's any felony. So I think you ought to be clear with the committee that, you know, it's not just sex offenders, it's not just the worst of the worst and people arrested for murder, it's any felony. And if not convicted, anyone who's arrested will have to give up DNA.
Correct, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Paymer, as I said in my opening statement, it's a two-phased approach. The first stage is for the arrested on the violent felonies. The second stage would be in 2010 for all felony arrestees. And as I also pointed out, there are instances in the anecdote from Chicago, for instance, someone who was arrested on theft had been ultimately convicted through the DNA as a condition of his release on parole to murder and rape cases.
Let's go to your testifiers if we can now at this point. Shall we take them in order? James Batcham, Dakota County Attorney.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representatives. James Batcham, Dakota County Attorney, also a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and a member of the Board of Directors of the National District Attorneys Association. I mentioned the latter this morning because I am asking to have handed out to your committee this morning the National District Attorneys Association's policies on DNA technology. The NDAA has spent a great deal of time. We've had some very talented and experienced attorneys that work in the DNA field daily. And a member of the Board of Directors of the National District Attorneys Association. I mentioned the latter this morning because I am asking to have handed out to your committee this morning the National District Attorneys Association's policies on DNA technology. The NDAA has spent a great deal of time. We've had some very talented and experienced attorneys that work in the DNA field daily that have analyzed this issue extensively. Our board has discussed this at length. We've adopted a very comprehensive policy position on the importance of DNA technology. This is the most powerful tool available to law enforcement today to prove the truth, and that's what the criminal justice process is all about. It is a truth-finding process. DNA technology is, as Representative Paulson indicated, today's fingerprint. It is used in courts all over this nation today to convict the guilty and to exonerate the innocent. This is, as you will review, and I don't expect you to review this today, but I would ask you to take a look at this as you deliberate on this important issue. But the National District Attorneys Association does support the collection of DNA technology from all those arrested for felony-level offenses, for crimes that occur. And this is important, and this is, and I would urge this committee to consider this no different than collecting fingerprints that started, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago in this country in terms of solving and aiding law enforcement and solving crime, because that's what DNA is. It is the modern fingerprint technology that's available, and it can be used and is being used today to solve crimes all over this nation. As Representative Paulson indicated, cold hits on the basis of the databases that exist, which the DNA, or which the BCA will explain to you in more detail than I can, but there's national networks now of databases of DNA technology that are available for sharing between law enforcement, just like the fingerprint technology that is shared through national databases that is analyzed when evidence is obtained from a crime scene. That is analyzed and then sent into computers today that then can pick out this genetic fingerprint of a person who was at that crime scene that may have left that biological sample and that can then be used for our ability to prove the truth of what happened and convict the guilty. So it is extremely important. And why for all felony offenses? Well, I think Representative Paulson had a great example of a property crime, but it is recognized that criminal behavior does not usually start at the upper end. It usually starts with property-level offenses, and then it escalates in time, and many of the property offenders in this country do escalate into more levels of violent offenses up to and including rapes and murders. In this country, and this DNA technology can be used to help law enforcement solve these crimes. Make no doubt about it, this bill is one of the most important tools to protect public safety in our state in the years ahead. It's extremely important, and it is supported by our state's prosecutors and our nation's prosecutors, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you this morning to offer my support for this important piece of legislation, and be happy to answer any questions, or if you want to hear from the BCA, and then I can come back and answer questions with them, whatever you want to do.
In any event, Mr. Backstrom, hang around. It looks like we have a question right now. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, Representative Ellison has expressed some concern about whether or not this particular bill is going to be in violation of the Constitution, due process, probable cause, those kinds of issues. I'm wondering if you could maybe comment on your feelings or your opinions as to whether or not this proposal is going to violate the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not believe this bill will create a constitutional violation. Just as the fingerprints of the past have stood the test of the constitutional standards of this nation and our courts, I believe the genetic fingerprints of DNA technology will meet those same standards. This is no different than collecting fingerprints and analyzing fingerprints, which are taken from everyone arrested today. And that's what we're asking to be done in connection with this bill. I do not believe it will rise to any constitutional violations that will be upheld by our nation's highest courts.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Jackson, the same term that Representative Paulson used on exonerating the innocent. Could you explain that a little more to me, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the DNA technology allows us to determine with extreme preciseness, you know, matching a particular biological sample at a crime scene to a particular suspect or a particular individual. And if the biological sample, the scrapings underneath the fingernail of the victim as she's fighting for her life, turns out not to be the DNA of the suspect that is picked out in by eyewitness testimony, then that particular individual, you know, would not be convicted of that crime, or if wrongly convicted, as has happened across our country, would have that conviction overturned if the DNA technology available does not match the suspect. It is not always true that and we need to keep this in mind, that DNA does not result in just automatic proof of guilt. It results in proof that a particular person was at a crime scene. You still have to tie the evidence together to prove that that particular person committed the offense that's being charged and so forth. But the DNA technology is extremely valuable, extremely important, and it's, in many cases, it might be the only evidence available for us to go forward and prove. And that's where the importance of getting these hits out of a database, which are happening right here in our state. And every one of those is enabling us to solve a crime and protect further victims down the road.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Murphy. But then what would happen to that innocent person who had been arrested and submitted their DNA and found to be innocent because the freaking out of the fingernails didn't match? What happens to that person's DNA then? That person's DNA is still in every other quest for the next time around?
Well, Matt, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, it is my belief that an innocent person does not have anything to fear from DNA technology, and it can be used to assist in the proof of their innocence that they have not committed the crime. And they do have in our state or elsewhere, and I think that's an opportunity for someone, a first-time offender, to use that tool that's being provided in this law to seek to remove that sample from the law enforcement agencies.
Representative Ellison, then Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. The remark you just made, Mr. Backstrom, makes me think about the idea that, why not have house-to-house searches at every house in Minnesota without regard to probable cause? Because, hey, if you have nothing to fear, why would you have a problem with somebody rummaging through your house if you're innocent? But my question is this: how many arrests are there in the state of Minnesota last year? How many of those cases resulted in either being declined or dismissed or never declined or dismissed and never resulting in any forward movement on the prosecution?
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that question statewide. I certainly can tell you from my office's perspective, there are many cases we don't go forward with in terms of seeking prosecution. I would venture to say it's probably between 20% and 30% of the cases that are referred to my office for prosecution for felonies, we do not proceed. Many of those, however, do get referred back to city attorneys for misdemeanor level prosecution if we don't believe the crime rises to the level of a felony. And I would, I hope that somewhat that information is somewhat helpful in terms of the answer to your questions. I don't have the data statewide.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Okay, one follow-up, then we're going to Representative Hillstrom, then we're getting on with our testimony. Representative Ellison.
Follow-up is that, so under the bill as proposed, that 20% or 30% would all have DNA on file with the BCA. Is that correct?
If they were arrested, many of the cases I'm referring to, Mr. Chair and Representative, would not involve a person that's been arrested. We get a lot of cases that are referred to our office without arrests being made. And remember, police officers, when they make arrests, have to do that on the basis of probable cause. They have to have a reasonable suspicion to believe a person is involved in criminal activity before they're going to put them, take their freedom away and put them in custody. And yes, the prosecutor has to analyze that, and we have many rules in place to protect those individuals' rights in terms of processing and making those decisions quickly within 36 hours after arrest. A lot of the cases I'm referring to, and I'm glad you asked this follow-up because I didn't clarify that earlier, are cases that do not involve arrests initially that are ultimately turned down when we review the case.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not certain you're the person to ask, but you were probably in the room when I did ask the question previously, and I probably will ask it again as well. But what about when you have DNA evidence and you think you know who committed the crime, but you can't really prove it because the DNA isn't on file, and then you have situations where people maybe arrest someone for another felony to get the DNA, and then you have the match, but they don't proceed with the case. The person might or might not be entitled to get it back, but you run the DNA and you find a match for another crime. You know, what happens? Is it constitutional then to use that evidence? Is there a problem in prosecuting that particular case?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, if law enforcement has the ability to obtain the sample from a suspect, and we can do that through a search warrant, too, and we do that today through search warrants, if we believe that we have someone that is a suspect of a crime that we can we are able to tie to a particular offense through probable cause, again, that we can show to a judge, and the judge authorizing us to proceed to take a biological sample from that suspect, we do that all the time. And when we do that and we compare that, if it doesn't match the DNA at our particular crime scene, you know, that's still something that we obtain through probable cause, a reasonable belief, and yes, that may be kept on file, and I believe it is kept on file. The BCA can answer to that probably better than I. And it could be used to solve future crimes. That's exactly what this bill does in terms of putting this into a database to use to protect our citizens when a crime has occurred, if we can match that sample or that genetic fingerprint to a particular suspect. And that protects all of us in our state in terms of future criminal behavior by an individual. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilson, we've just run out of time on questions. I ask one final one.
Okay.
We're moving along.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, sure. What if the person isn't a suspect, never was a suspect in the case, but is arrested over here and then wasn't found guilty, was not charged, but the DNA goes in and then you find a match?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I would suggest that that is in the interest of public safety. That is a good thing when we are able to solve an unsolved crime because we have a fingerprint, whether it's a fingerprint from your finger or a genetic fingerprint on file that we can compare to solve an unsolved offense where there's a victim out there that has suffered, a victim's family that has suffered from an offense. We're able to use the technology of today to solve those crimes. That is a good thing for public safety in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. I'm going to ask Mr. Johnson, Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, to come to the table. Mr. Backstrom, if you could stay for the next 10 minutes and just listen. Also, anyone who's testifying, if in listening to questions that have been raised, if you care to submit a memo to the committee by sending it to me, either supporting or contradicting any answers to questions, we would appreciate ongoing input because we will be laying this on the table at some point this morning and taking it up at a later time. Mr. Johnson, would you proceed?
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Harlan Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and we represent over 300 police chiefs in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, when a serious crime is committed, a police chief will utilize every tool at his disposal to solve that crime, bring the perpetrator to justice, and try to bring closure to the victim or to the victim's family. This bill will provide a tool to help police with the job. When a crime is committed and there's no one around, the police arrive to a victim that can't tell you what happened to them or by whom. The police must look for clues. DNA is an undisputed piece of evidence as good as or even better than fingerprints. You've heard talk about fingerprints today. I was involved in the first case in Minnesota that was solved by MANFIN, which was the Minnesota Automated Fingerprint Identification Network. I was called to investigate a robbery, an armed robbery at a drugstore, where a man pulled a gun on the pharmacist and demanded drugs, and while he was there, he'd take some cash to go with it. The only evidence we had was a description of the perpetrator and that he had been standing in an area by some lilt permanents. Went to that area and found one that was out of sequence. We fingerprinted it, sent it to the DCA lab. Within a few days, I got a call from a very giddy lab tech from DCA saying, "We solved it. We've identified who the person is, and we even know where he lives." As a result of that, we made the arrest, and we were happy that we solved this. So I'd say it worked. We can do the same with this tool. Since it will be housed in DCA, we feel there's little chance or risk of improper usage of the data that's stored. Where people talk about clearing cold case, and when I talked to DCA about that, they also referred to the Virginia sample. I have a friend who is the chief of the executive director of the Virginia Chiefs of Police Association, so I called her and asked her, and she says that, and confirmed what BCA told me, is that they're solving 8 to 10 cold crimes for every 1,000 samples that they collect. The other is this tool saves a lot of further investigation. There are a lot of high-profile cases in Minnesota that you all remember where millions of dollars were spent on investigation but where they didn't have a lead to begin with. This DNA sample or the modern fingerprint may provide that lead. Mr. Chairman, thank you for listening to me and for all you do for Minnesota.
Mr. Johnson, same to you. Thank you for coming today. Frank DeLeschi, Director of the BCA Laboratory. Could you come forward? Give us the correct pronunciation of your last name and then tell us what you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Dolish. It's I can understand why you wouldn't be able to pronounce it from the spelling. I wanted to be able to give you a little bit of a background of so this committee understands how this database system is working under current law and what it means for cases in this state. So I want to give you a little bit of history about the database system. Was put in place in law in 1989 and required at that time DNA samples from convicted sex offenders. At that time we were getting about 1,000 samples a year under that law. And at that time we were taking DNA, because of the technology we were using then, we required a whole blood sample be taken from the individual. So back when we started, the technique was a little bit more invasive than it is today. In 1991, we had the first cold hit off of that DNA database. It was a murder-homicide in Minneapolis. Sometime after that, we connected to the federal DNA database that's managed by the FBI. We submit convicted adult felons to that database, and we have the first cold hit in that national database in 1993, linking a person that had committed offense in Minnesota to, I believe it was a case in Wisconsin. In 1999, we came online with some new DNA technology based on something called short tandem repeats, and we, with that technology, were able to process samples quicker. But because it looks at a little bit different portion of the DNA, we had to go back and redo the samples that we had in the database at that time. In 2000, the database was expanded to include predatory offenders, those arrested for predatory offenses. And in 2002, it was expanded to include all felons. That was renewed for another 2 years in 2003. And that law will sunset this year unless a bill is passed. In the governor's budget, there is funding for continuing the convicted felony offenses, so at least that part of Representative Paulson's bill, I believe, would be supported by the governor. The status of our database, we have approximately 31,000 profiles in the Minnesota database. We have a current backlog of about 19,700 samples, and the reason for that backlog is when this body and your sister body in the Senate passed this all-felony legislation 3 years ago, we were funded to collect the samples but not to analyze the samples. We have been able to get some federal grants to run those samples, and there's a breakdown here of those samples that will be run by federal grants before the end of the year. All of the states in this nation have DNA database programs. I believe that most of them have, I have the number later on. There,
Mr. Village, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Would you be able to come back tomorrow?
I would.
I think in all fairness to the importance of what you have for us through the time, we have one other testifier, a citizen advocate. I'd like to give him 5 minutes today. I would like you to come back tomorrow. We'll see if we can fit the balance of today's presentation in at the first part of our committee hearing tomorrow or at the tail end. We'll work that detail out, but I'd ask you to simply conclude right now and then see you tomorrow.
Thank you. I'll be back for questions.
Sure. I'm sorry about that, but thank you for your courtesy. Mr. Neumeister, if you'd have a seat, and then we'll go to any... I'd like to give you 5 minutes, and then we'll go to discussion. You also can come back tomorrow if you can't conclude. Have a seat, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. Let's start out real quick. A fingerprint is not a fingerprint, as the proponents are talking about. A fingerprint is a profile, which will be on, and you'll maybe see in the presentation, but they keep a sample based on an arrest, a sample that has essence of your life, of your heredity, your genetic, things that may happen to you, the color of your eyes. So that's one of the concerns. That's one of the differences. They keep the sample based on an arrest. Secondly, the folks have said, well, they're under current law, it's not like a fingerprint, but this is what it's like, a fingerprint, but they're making a difference here, a distinct difference. Representative Smith and Representative Murphy and some of the other folks may remember the big floor fight when this bill came up, when Mr. Bishop wanted to say no DNA samples could be forever. And that's why you have the portion in law on page 6 that says, on the top of line 6, DNA samples and DNA records of the arrested person shall not be returned till they're destroyed as to a charge supported by probable cause. So if there is no probable cause, you go under the old 299C11. This is how I've always, and because I'm the one who worked a lot with the folks on those, that stuff and little notes, that if you go under 299C11 and if there's no basis of probable cause, you can, that record should be able to come back. But that's a determination. You know, I don't know if there's been any court cases on that. One of the things I'd like to point out in the few moments I have is that here are the statute books. And one of the things, let's on some of them. In California, but California says, granted, on arrestees under the new thing that was adopted by a ballot. Yes, we keep the samples, but the law enforcement agency that collects the samples within 2 years have to let their equivalent of their BCA, hey, there's no, you can destroy the record, which is different than sealing. If basically they're not going to do anything, it's a false arrest or whatever it might be. Yes, there is a court process in there, which is similar to ours. This state statute book, Code of Virginia, one of the best and comprehensive DNA laws in the country, which we can learn about from Minnesota. Whether or not you adopt to start collecting DNA samples based on arrest, we can learn some things, and I've talked to Representative Paulson about whatever happens policy-wise, we need some laws for protection and some other kinds of things. What they have in here, based on probable cause, is that before a sample is taken, it goes before a magistrate. And only felony, violent felony kinds of things, not all felonies. Texas, basically, it's all violent felonies, sexual kinds of things like that. There are 161,073 Part 1 and Part 2 arrests done in 2002, according to the Uniform Code, Uniform Crime Report. There were over about 54,000 juveniles. In the literature that I've been seeing all the way from the Racial Bias Task Force, where I've been looking for numbers based on the question that Mr. Ellison has been asking about how many are dismissed outright, false arrests, I can only say that there could be from 6 to 7% in the state of Minnesota to a third. And even when Mr. Backstrom made some comments, that goes to a third, at least what I'm seeing as done in other states. Mr. Chairman, I've got about another minute.
Yes, you do, and you also will have some time tomorrow if you need to conclude then.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What I've tried to illustrate very quickly in the amount of time that I have is that there are some important issues, and this shouldn't just be done willy-nilly. I do know that based on, if we go forward with the proposal for an expungement on based on arrest, it's going to be hard than heck to do something. I did an informal survey with some attorneys, talked. I said, hold my name, and I'm interested, is $1,500 to start, to $3,000, according to an NPR report that I have a record of. I mean, you can look at all the documents that I have. I have no problem with that. So those are some of the concerns of the cost, and then the burdensome of it. So what I've tried to do is illustrate to you some things, some examples, and I'm always around. I'll be around, and as the chairperson said, this is going to be one that there will be a little bit more discussion on. It's not going to be done today, and so in summary, let's do be thoughtful about this. Let's take a look at the Court of Appeals decision that makes it harder for expungements. Let's take a look when juveniles for fleeing a police officer or shoplifting, which is a felony offense, all of a sudden. Let's look at the disparate amount rates of population with poor and racial that happens in these kinds of things. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is not the open panacea. You do a DNA arrest on the internet, and you'll see all different kinds of points of view. And granted, I just want to lay something to rest. There's probably the constitutionality that you can do a swab. I mean, this is not more. There's basically case law is saying that basically can be done. The issue is what you do afterwards and what are the ways for an innocent person to get that record back, particularly the sample. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the few moments of the time that I've been allotted.
Thank you. Representative Meslow, you were on my list to recognize, and then we'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm pleased that we're going to be able to take this up tomorrow, and frankly that we'll have a night to sleep on this, because I think as we do, there are things that we can consider as we look forward. I do not think that the question for us to consider is where are we headed from here. I think that that's frankly a mistake as we consider all bills that are before us. The question is this bill. It's not what's going to happen with misdemeanors or what's going to happen in hospitals. We've got a decision before us to make on this bill, and that's what I'm considering as we go forward. As we do that, first, I'd just like to offer the committee's my perspective as I've had experience both as a prosecutor and a defense lawyer with numerous expungements. I have not found it to be an expensive process. I have had many defendants who have done that without the benefit of attorney. There are forms that are available certainly within Ramsey County to do that. And so that has become a readily available process, and I want you to know that that is available out there, just speaking as somebody who's been on the front line with many of those. As I've considered this, I've thought when we involve technology and when there is a new technology that's available, it's natural that we get a little bit squishy about this. But I think really the question is whether this is different than the fingerprint procedure that has been in place for decades. We have been taking fingerprints of people upon arrest for decades, and the question is this so different? Is this so invasively different? I would tell you that it is different, and in the way that it's different, it is more accurate. This is better information. Whether it leads to an arrest or whether it leads to a conviction or whether it leads to someone who has their case then dismissed and is discharged. This is better information, better evidence, and the longer I've listened, the more I've heard what's here today, the more sense that it makes to me, and I'm going to be sleeping on this, thinking about it tonight. Look forward to hearing what the other members have to say as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
Thank you. Representative Paulson, it was my intent, and we will lay this bill on the table. I had hoped we would conclude, but we're going to view the tail end of Mr. Dolish's presentation tomorrow. And all good things take time. So we'll,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that hope, we'll lay your bill on the table. This meeting is adjourned.